Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we bring you part two of our five-part series on the Palmyra murders. We last left off with a tense family dinner, leaving Buck and Stephanie resolved to sail their rickety boat across the Pacific Ocean. Today, Buck and Stephanie cast off the shackles of land living and head to the open sea. We have storms, dwindling food supplies, explosive vomiting, navigation mishaps, and a bunch of dogs. Get ready for some stress. This series is based on the excellent book And the Sea Will Tell by Vincent Bugliosi.
Oh, man. Last night, Mira and I went for like a 5-mile walk, and most of the time we just talked about how much we're like Stephanie and Buck.
I know. I mean, you probably won't feel that way as the story progresses.
Right.
But as of right now, I have a deep affinity for these dumb
hippie criminals.
Rationalizing bad decisions.
Yeah, totally.
I just...
Being treated very carefully by their loved ones.
I kept reading it. I was like, I feel attacked by this book.
It's great. All right, look, hey, man, if anyone out there is looking to connect with us, find at Muriel's Murders on all the basic, you know, whatever social media sites. Just like if probably, I don't know if there's any, there's probably like newer, cooler ones or something. Like, I don't even know all the social
TikTok.
Media sites. We're on TikTok. We're locked out of the account, I think, but not because we did anything cool. I think it logged us out and I don't, whatever. Just find us on TikTok. Maybe I'll sign back in. You know what I'm saying? Find us at whatever the things are, Instagram, Twitter. We are active on our personal accounts, but I do see when you tag Muriel's Murders and I read the comments and DMs on the podcast accounts, and we love hearing from you all. Same with the reviews on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you can email us through our website, murdersmurders.com. We're doing this together, you guys, and your words of support just make us glow. You know what I mean? We just like, that gives us the energy to go on these 5-mile walks every night, you know, to stay healthy and motivated and alive and inspired.
Oh my God.
We're going to build a boat. We're going to sail to you guys, you know?
You are just a ball of wonderful things. Okay. An arancini.
Okay.
Filled with good things.
Okay, good.
Wait.
Our cat is running around. I don't know. I have to stop him. I don't know if that's being picked up on the microphones. Okay, Muriel, hit him with the thing.
Okay, this is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and don't want to hear about those kind of things, just go listen to a different podcast.
We're going to joke. We're probably going to have some swear words. Plus our cat, there might be weird background noises. So if you're like one of these podcast purists that are like, how dare you? Like, there's a car honking outside our window. Guys, this is this podcast. If you hate all that, turn us off.
We're podcasting in the city, baby. All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay, let's get started. On June 1st, 1974, at sunrise, Buck Walker and Stephanie Stern sailed away from Port Allen on Kauai, beginning their grand adventure, their very first attempt at blue water, open ocean sailing, 1,000 miles in what should have been about 5 to 7 days.
I know, you said 29 days.
I was wrong.
Okay.
28 days.
Okay, all right. 28 days later.
Ugh. Up until this point, Buck had done a little daytime cruising around the coastline. Stephanie had never even steered a boat before purchasing the Iola. So, cool, man.
Yeah, cool.
Lots of stuff to like, yeah. Lots of new experiences to have.
Uh-huh.
And blue water sailing is a pretty different beast than sailing around the coastline. Again, remember, I don't know how to use a boat, but I did read a lot about it. So yes. I think that this is, I'm going to explain this to you because I also know that you don't know how to drive a boat.
No, if anything, we're cursed with boats. Like if there's an oar involved, I don't even think we've ever gotten to a motor, anything with a motor or a sail. But if there's a paddle or an oar, it's guaranteed we're going in circles. We're going to crash.
And we're going to fight the entire time.
Yeah. Also not good with inner tubes. Like no. If there's a peaceful river thing, anyways. Too many stories to tell. We have
boat. It's way too many, but if you can picture two people trying to row a canoe and just spinning down a river for 3 hours, you can think about like what we did on our really fun vacation in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, just getting laughed at by every local on every bridge we went under.
Yeah, so like okay. So that's what we're dealing with right now. That's the level of knowledge that we have. And so I'm going to try to explain this in a way that's simple. Okay.
Okay, good.
So blue water sailing is pretty significantly different than sailing around the coast. The ocean, like the deep, expansive, wide ocean beyond the coastlines behaves really differently, right? And you have a whole nother set of things. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of different opinions. I've read a bunch of blogs and some argumentative posts on a cruiser's forum. But I think basically the prevailing thought is blue water sailing, which refers to sailing basically in a body of water where you can't see any land, is significantly more advanced than coastal sailing. So from what I understand, sailing close to the coast is more like making correct change. And then blue water sailing is like Goodwill Hunting, chalkboard math, very complicated, lots of moving parts, right?
Yeah, like the weird like person in the corner is actually the genius
right.
at it.
Exactly. Okay. And that's especially true for smaller boats like the 30-foot Iola. So even though 30-foot sailboat seems really big, it's actually fairly small for open ocean sailing. And it makes sense, right? Like the larger the boat is, the more stable it is.
Yeah.
And you're talking about just waves that are bigger than your apartment building. You
yeah,
know?
Right. So just huge, rolling, uncontrollable, just masses of power.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's truly terrifying.
And also, just take into account, the Coast Guard is typically next to the coast, right? So
they do build that into the name.
Right.
It's good branding.
Exactly. So they're there to help bail out the sailors whose ambitions outmatch their skills, right? I think the idea is closer to the coast, there are just more boats and more things going on. So sometimes people feel like it's more difficult sailing because you have to avoid people doing stupid things and other boats in the water.
Yeah.
But even if something really terrible happens, it's pretty easy to be rescued.
Sure.
In blue water, a tiny sailboat is basically on its own, and any mistakes carry big consequences. So it's a really, really brutal place to learn how to sail as you go.
Yeah, no, it's horrible. It's like learning how to walk, trying to do the tightrope between skyscrapers or something.
Right. And the journeys by nature, when you're talking about like these huge expanses of water, the journeys are just longer. So blue water sailing journeys are typically weeks long journeys, right? And if something breaks on this long journey, you have to fix it or you can die. Especially, for instance, if you bought sacks of flour and sugar instead of a ship-to-shore radio you could use to call for help, right?
Yeah, they wanted to do some baking. Yeah. She needed to bust out some croissants.
And, you know, they need food, but that's wild.
Yeah.
But Stephanie and Buck were prepared in their own way. The tiny cabin of the Iola was absolutely packed to the gills with sacks of flour, sugar, rice, beans, cooking oil, cans of food, all kinds of stuff. And these were the provisions they needed not only to survive the trip, but to survive on Palmyra, the tropical island where they were heading.
Yeah.
Now, the boat wasn't big enough to store years worth of provisions. Remember, Buck and Stephanie wanted to stay on Palmyra for 2 to 3 years, right? And they did not have enough room to store that much food. Luckily, Buck and Stephanie had a plan. They were going to grow a crap ton of weed, okay? They had a big old sack of seeds, and they had already lined up distributors. Dickie and Carlos, the Taylor brothers, were planning on picking up the first crop of weed from Palmyra in August. And then when they did, they would bring in fresh food supplies.
Oh, okay.
So it was like a circle of life thing.
Okay,
right?
That's good. I thought you were going to say, then they're going to make weed brownies with all that sugar and flour and eat that.
No, they were tying everything in to kind of incentivize people to come down to the island and bring them more food because they didn't really have any other choice.
Sounds like probably their smartest idea yet.
I kind of think I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
But until the Taylor brothers arrived, Buck and Stephanie would supplement their food stores with fish and coconuts on the island. And then by the end of the year, they'd all be rich.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
So while the weed slash supplies slash pothead brothers scheme seemed pretty airtight, other preparations for the journey had been less flawless. Buck had successfully acquired a new identity that would be the husband of one of his sexy gal pals. Remember, he had an open relationship on his side, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he had a girlfriend on the big island who had a husband who had severe brain damage. So this husband had been working as a professional rodeo cowboy until his career was cut short after a horse kicked him in the head.
Wow, that's a rough hand.
Yeah. And now that guy lived in a convalescent home, and Buck had all of his identification papers.
What a stand-up guy.
So Buck's new name was now Roy Allen, the perfect cover except for the giant buck tattoo on his arm. So Buck and Stephanie also decided to bring three dogs on the trip. Now, for people who don't sail, maybe you'd be like, well, people like dogs.
Yeah.
That's not a very common thing. Like,
okay,
bringing three dogs on a small boat for like a long journey.
That you have to feed and like what? Have their pee just be rolling around the cabin of the deck?
So I want you, when you think of this journey,
to
just remember what you just said as a backdrop to, you know, whatever's happening on the boat. It's also there's dogs pooping on the deck. So the way it went down is Stephanie had this little dog named Puffer, like a little fluffy mutt, pretty small.
Is that the one that survived? Because at the part one started with her swimming to shore with this little dog.
Yeah, so that's the same little dog.
Oh, okay. That's good. That's good. We know at least one person, good, pure thing, survives this story.
So she said, I can't leave my dog behind. So then Buck said, fine, if you're bringing your dogs, I'm taking my dogs. His two big, mostly untrained dogs. That was a lab mix and then a male pit bull who really liked biting.
Okay. Oh, those old school pits. Now they're all friendly and great. But pits back in the day were vicious.
Well, this particular dog was big and really, as we go on in this journey, just would be chomping. Right?
Okay. All right.
So to keep the dogs from being lost at sea, Buck bought 80 feet of netting and then just wrapped the entire boat around from bow to stern to keep like, so the boat tipped, the dogs might fall into the net instead of just falling out into the ocean.
Okay.
Right. That's a plan.
That's something.
They also crammed 150 pounds of dog food into the overflowing cabin. Then good to go.
That's not that much. I'm sorry. 150
I completely
pounds?
Agree with you. I was trying to do the math and I was like,
that's
does
not that
seem...
many bags of dog food, really.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep going. Sorry.
For blue water sailing, you need weeks of water and fuel stored up. They had 30 gallons of water, so about enough for 2 weeks of water for two people, not including the dogs, in terms of recommendations for sailing.
Mm-hmm.
They also had some fuel. You need extra fuel to get out of hairy situations. That's why it's really important. So like your main source of power is sailing.
Yeah.
But if something like a hurricane forms, you need the option to motor out of there really fast because waiting for the right wind in a situation like that could get you killed, you know? So that's why you would stockpile that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the fuel became an issue almost immediately. When they cast off, the couple caught a lucky gust of wind, and the Iola glided effortlessly into the open ocean. But as soon as they were clear of Hawaii and the cops and all the problems of land life keeping them down, the wind died, and they were left bobbing haplessly in the water. They hadn't been able to stockpile the recommended amount of fuel, so they had way, way too little to use so early in the journey. So they just kind of had to wait and sit and wait for the winds to start up again. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how the misery began.
On day one.
The wind that day would pick up and die, pick up and die. So they decided to take down the mainsail and put up the jib. So the jib is a small sail, and their logic was to match this weak, erratic wind, they'd use this smaller sail. I'm not going to explain all the mechanics behind it because I barely understand it myself. But even though it seems this choice had its own internal logic to use this smaller sail, the choice to use the jib in this particular situation was a beginner's mistake. And what it did was cause the boat, instead of to sail forward gracefully, it caused the boat to slowly lurch through the water, jerking up and down until everyone on board was incredibly sick. And at first, they took turns at the helm, right? But soon, Buck was so ill and so seasick, he just gave up and crawled below deck to the cramped cabin to sort of rest from his seasickness. And there he stayed for the first week at sea. This left Stephanie completely alone to sail the Iola. She wasn't strong enough to hoist the mainsail by herself. So for the first week at sea, they just stuck to the small sail, to the jib, meaning the boat basically crawled along at a snail's pace, all while sort of rolling crazily in the waves for days. So whatever choice they made that made Buck sick in the first place,
they just kept that.
They just kept that for about a week because she couldn't do anything else.
He sounds like a Danny McBride character or something. Just like a totally clueless, overly confident douchebag who just like forces his will on people and then just everything fails.
Yes. So for his part, Buck stayed below deck, wallowing in misery, reading spy novels on their tiny one-person bunk, and making a huge dent in their limited food supply.
Of course he is.
Buck came up with the idea that hearty eating would give him strength and cure his seasickness. So every morning, he'd make himself a big breakfast, head up to the deck, and vomit everything up. And then he'd rinse and repeat for the rest of the day. Eat, vomit, smoke some pot. Eat, vomit, clean his guns. Eat, vomit, read a spy novel. And then meanwhile, Stephanie was topside, her hair caked in salt, hands raw, skin blistered and sunburned, just trying to keep this bobbing ship headed due south.
Oh, man, it would have been so funny if she just slowly did a U-turn and didn't tell him.
Yeah, it's like, we are going our ass. That's what I would do. I'd be like, I don't know what happened. We just started going home.
Oops. What's her mind frame during this? Do you know?
It's all the same. It's pretty consistent, at least based on the book.
Yeah.
Which I think is largely, the book is based on her account of events, mm-hmm, that as told to her lawyer. So Vincent Bugliosi was one of her defense lawyers.
The author of the book.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so it's a really interesting perspective. So while he was trying to build the case, you know, this is all the stuff that she told him. So this is mostly Stephanie's
perspective. Sure, okay.
But given that, you know, she's really consistent in her optimism. So, you know, in the last episode when her family said, you're going to die. Yeah. And she said, I just think that, you know, I thank you so much for your love. Like, yeah, I take your concern as love and I'll move on to do my thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, around this time, she's thinking, Buck is depressed. This isn't working out as smoothly as we thought it would
be.
Yeah,
and he's trusting me. So this is great, man. I got this. I'm the captain now.
It kind of vacillated. And I think between like, okay, is this working or are we in dangerous territory? Uh-huh. And one of the things she talks about is while they were on land and living in Hawaii, maybe that was kind of chaotic, but he was definitely very loving mm-hmm. and supportive, and they were vibing together, you know, pretty well. And once they hit the water and they got in a position where things got really bad.
Yeah, they had to deal with the consequences of their incredibly stupid decisions.
Buck kind of stopped picking up the slack. He started dropping the slack. And it was this kind of situation where, okay, you've got two people on a boat, and if they make a mistake, someone's going to die. And Buck really started to push the envelope of like, yeah, but what if I don't do anything? And mm-hmm. so my impression is you have this guy who, when there's no outside consequences, like meaning societal consequences to doing what he feels like doing, like they're on a boat. There's nothing that Stephanie can do. She can't get in her van and drive away while he throws rocks at it, right? Yeah. She can't escape. They're here. And once they're in this captive position, his personality started to change a little bit.
Yeah.
And so this beginning of the journey, she couldn't, his dad had recently passed away in a work accident. Mm. And so she thought maybe he's depressed mm-hmm. and this is like supposed to be this fantasy. And he had a fantasy for a long time about sailing around the world. And it was just really brutal. It wasn't really fun, right? And so she kind of felt like, he's depressed. I'm going to let him work through this. He's really sick and I'll just continue to do it. And he'll come catch up with me when he's ready.
Yeah.
And so this entire trip, they were kind of going back and forth between, is he incapable of doing this because he's so at such a low point in his life? Or is he deciding to hide and just allow the work to fall on me?
Mm. Classic. Seems like the entire struggle of the male-female dichotomy throughout the hippie movement in general. I don't know. I've listened to Joni Mitchell. It sounds like what she was talking about.
You know, I get what you're saying. And the other thing that was going on, it wasn't just that he wasn't helping with sailing the ship, but there's physically things she can't do, right? Like hoist the mainsail by herself, and she couldn't move their outboard motor. So when we talk about sailboat main power of you know, main energy source is the wind, mm-hmm. but these like crucial elements of motoring, you know, they're important, especially in open water.
Yeah, obviously they're important.
Right. Okay. So the other thing that was happening is that the outboard motor was just lying out there on the deck. And the thing about that is that the elements and salt water and things like that will ruin it if you don't protect it and cover it. She wasn't strong enough to lift it. And Buck was just basically like, I'm too sick. And so
I'm too busy cooking.
They only had one motor and it was just kind of rusting and freezing on the deck.
That is, yeah, this is just every nightmare.
Yeah. And also, old boat, we talked about how it had lived at the bottom of the harbor for a long time, already been patched and patched and patched.
It's
and
haunted?
Patched. What?
It's haunted?
No.
Oh.
What?
You said old boat, bottom of the harbor, covered in barnacles like the ghosts of an old pirate.
No, it's just been patched over and over again. And so it's not like a solid hull. There's all like the hull, H-U-L-L. And as they're out at sea and things are jostling around and the waves are beating the boat, it's starting to leak. And it's starting to leak really, really badly.
Oh, my God.
And this was basically calm seas and good weather. There was no storm or anything like that. This is just kind of as good as it gets.
Uh-huh.
About a week into the journey, right about the time that they should have been pulling into Palmyra's Lagoon, Stephanie was again alone at the helm in the middle of the ocean with no land in sight. So the sun is setting, and for the very first time, black clouds started to fill the sky out of nowhere. The gang was about to encounter their first squall at sea.
Squall.
Yeah. So a squall is kind of like the sledgehammer blow of storms. It's very quick. So when you're talking about the clouds coming in really fast, right? Yeah. and very, very powerful. So as soon as Stephanie clocked these odd black clouds moving in, she was hit with the really powerful wind and everything was totally out of control, right? Really quickly. And so she starts screaming for Buck. And Stephanie had tried to enforce a rule on the Iola to always wear a life vest in inclement weather when you're on deck. So not all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like if things are going down, just make sure you wear a life vest when you're on deck. And Buck was like, absolutely not.
Quit being a square.
That's so dumb. And his thing was, if I ever get swept overboard,
yeah,
you can just toss me a life jacket. That's a real plan. So anyway, Buck heard Stephanie screaming and he threw down his spy novel, scrambled up from the cabin, slipped on the wet deck, and immediately smashed his face on a metal bar, knocking himself unconscious.
It is jumping into action to save his damsel in distress.
Just literally within, the whole thing is, if you can picture, like maybe less than a minute of clouds, scream, run, smash. From there, Buck slowly rolled down the deck.
Clouds, scream, Buck, smash.
Buck slowly rolled down the deck toward the ocean where he was snagged in the dog netting.
Oh, nice. Good.
Yeah.
Good. The dogs are like, know how to keep their balance. They're totally fine. Zero risk of them falling. He goes overboard immediately.
In the middle of this raging squall, Jen had no choice but to tie down the wheel and help Buck back down to the cabin because he couldn't walk. She didn't want him to drown. So there in the cabin, she throws on all her rain gear and she hooks herself up to a harness that at least would keep her attached to the boat if she got tossed overboard. That's the best she could do.
Uh-huh.
Stephanie returned to the helm to just get blasted in the face with water over and over again, just sprays of seawater. The dogs are flying everywhere. The Iola hits this big wave and it swings to the side at a super crazy angle, like a capsized style of angle, right?
Right, just sideways. Like in the movies or something, you know, like they show that angle of the boat going crazy in the trailer of the movies.
Right, so that's enough for Buck to spring to life again. He's in the cabin, he realizes the cabin's sideways.
Uh-huh.
So again, life jacketless, Buck runs up from below deck, but this time though, he managed to get to the wheel, which he used to wrestle the boat upright again. And then the weather broke and everything was over. And it's another illustration of how she just needed somebody strong up on the boat, like doing stuff. It's so hard. This task was so hard for someone to do alone. So the weather broke, the ship was righted, and Buck went back downstairs to sleep off his concussion. So, Nick, I know you have this thing about whales, right?
Yeah.
And I'm assuming you have kind of the same thing about deep sea shenanigans in general.
In general, I mean, it is whales. It's the whale sort of supersedes the deep seas, to be honest. I'm more scared of the whale floating at me in any scenario, like in space or just through the air or just in my dreams or in my visions, or even like when you go to the aquarium and they have like a big whale.
I remember you didn't like that.
You know, or like, you know, at the natural New York Museum of whatever the hell, where the squid and the whale are fighting, like all of those, like it's all of that is terrifying.
Okay. So my thing that supersedes the ocean, which does kind of scare me a little bit, my whale, we're about to talk about. So the part of this sailboat journey that freaks me out about as much as your whale thing is the math part of sailing.
That's really funny.
So for Stephanie, the scariest thing happening on the Iola, given all of this stuff, like Buck's behavior changes and this idea that like she is really stuck on this boat, no radio, there's nothing she can do.
Dehydrated.
She has to hope that he just starts to change his mind, right? And the squalls and all that stuff. The scariest thing was something that she hadn't even really been able to say out loud at this point. She had absolutely no idea where they were. they should have reached Palmyra days earlier, and there was just nothing. No boats, no land, just water.
Yeah.
Now, Stephanie had cheerfully volunteered to be the navigator on the trip. She had never done any nautical navigating before, so she checked out some books on navigating using stars and constellations to sort of bone up on whatever, or learn it.
Bone up on centuries of like genius work to figure out how to make that happen.
And she also brought a copy of 10 Easy Steps to Navigation along for the journey. And that was going to be her Bible.
Yeah, Survival at Sea for Dummies.
Right. And the book was a step-by-step guide that involved getting the exact time from a transistor radio. They did have a radio, not mm-hmm. that you could communicate with, but one that you could get the time on the dot. You know, did you ever used to call that number?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, there used to be like a hotline and they go 1024, 1025, you know.
Uh-huh. Okay, so this was the radio version of that?
Yes. So you get the exact time from the radio, and then you'd go up on deck. I'm not going to explain this very well. You go up on deck, and you look at the position of the sun and the horizon through this gadget that is mm-hmm. special, like a spectrometer or something like that. And then using all of those positions and numbers and the compass and the time, and using those numbers and positions and whatever and calculations and an algorithm something something from this book, she was supposed to be able to pinpoint their exact location on a map. So every morning Stephanie would faithfully listen to the radio, get the time, go up, take the measurements, sit down in the cabin and do her calculations, and then repeat the same thing 4 hours later. And every single day, her calculations would show something different.
Just because they were completely different?
They maybe had traveled 300 miles south of Hawaii, okay. And then next time, 700 miles east of Hawaii. So basically like these... Oh. Crazy go nuts locations, impossible distances, not the like things that go opposite to the way that the compass had been pointing.
No, that is a nightmare.
The math is just really not working.
I couldn't do that. I mean, if I read a recipe like to cook and I'm cooking a meal or even just one dish, I have to go back to that recipe 3 times between every step. Like if it's like tablespoon salt, half tablespoon pepper, whatever hot sauce, and then mix it together, I'm like, cool, got it. How much salt? And then I go look, I'm like 1 tablespoon, and then I do it and I go, great, all right, boom. But how much? There's no way. It would be impossible.
It reminds me, I used to work at the farmer's market for this jam company, and they paid me nothing. And I had to, at the end of the day, balance the product against the cash, right? Which seems like it should be really easy. You yeah. count the inventory.
Like, we made $45,000 selling boysenberry jam.
One day, I got a different number. I did it, I think, 5 or 6 times, yeah. and I got a different number every time. And then I just started crying and I couldn't stop. And I was just crying, trying to put the jam back in their stupid storage locker. And then I got lost and couldn't find their storage locker. And it was the worst day of my life. So that's like what this reminds me
that's
of.
That's your whale.
You just keep doing it and the number just keeps changing. You don't hit the same number twice. Like nightmare, right?
I want to also say something. We're going to get back to the story. I know there's a lot of diatribes. A lot of people listening here don't know that Muriel is like a very accomplished, hilarious comedic actress who's very skilled. And out of every character that we've ever covered in this entire show, we've done like hundreds of episodes at this point, I think Stephanie, it would be the most perfect character for you to play.
I will just say, I think I appreciate the way that you said that. But the truth is just that we're very similar. So Stephanie just keeps getting yeah. these bad numbers. Eventually she tells Buck. Buck's like, well, you know, stuff happens, right? What are we going to do? So they decided to ditch the calculations entirely and focus on the compass, right? Palmyra was basically due south from their launch point in Hawaii. So, you know, they just decided, well, we'll just use the stupid compass, right? That's what we'll do. We won't make it more complicated than it needs to be. But deep down, Stephanie knew that that's still going to be kind of sticky because Palmyra, like we said, is really small. It's about 4 miles across. And because it was an atoll, this coral formation, right? The land is basically flat. So the highest elevation on Palmyra is around 6 feet. You can't see it at all from sea unless you're within 8 to 10 miles. So without precise navigation.
Right. You can't be like, oh, there's the thing way over there. Let's just go that way.
Right. Without precise navigation, it would be more likely that they'd overshoot Palmyra and just keep following their compass due south to the edge of the world while Buck gorged himself on food, vomited it overboard, and then they just slowly ran out of water. You know, she's definitely in this position where Buck is like, it's okay, baby, we'll just use the compass. And she's like, yeah, totally, baby. Just like, oh my God. So on the 10th day of the voyage, after stressing, hitting her head against the wall, working the 10 easy steps to navigation over and over and over again, coming up with wild numbers, Stephanie had a dream. And she woke up realizing she'd been doing her stupid calculations using an algorithm for the wrong side of the stupid equator. So for sure she was heading south, but she was still on the north side of the equator. So she needed to use the north algorithm and not the south algorithm. I'm not going to explain that any further. We kind of get the gist, right?
I mean, it also is really funny, this idea that she just realized she made a mistake, and that sort of like thought of checking your actions against reality to her felt like a dream. Imagine that.
Yeah, man.
She's just like, this rational thought just feels like an otherworldly fantasy.
Well, it's one of those things where you're like, this is impossible. Why? And then you have it on backwards.
Yeah.
That's something like
your bra every morning.
I'm like, why is this so painful? So she calculated their position, this time using the right algorithm, and found their position. In 10 days, they had made it halfway to Palmyra. They weren't even close. Remember, we said 5 to 7 days and they'll get there. 10 days, they're halfway.
Right. And it's probably because of the stupid jib thing. But it means she's going in the right direction.
Yeah, it does. I mean, they were really pumped. And to his credit, Buck was like, you're a genius.
Uh-huh.
Christopher Columbus should have had you on his boat and he never would have gotten lost. We're drinking rum. Very into it.
This we have to turn this into a movie. Are you kidding me right now? Or a series with like Danny McBride and I don't know who. We have to find the right casting, but that's too much.
So they're halfway to Palmyra. And then the other thing that's going on is that they were eating into the food at this point so far that they were eating into the part of the food they needed to survive on the island. They had gotten through the food that they had allocated for the journey.
Sure.
And now they're into like the stuff that's going to get us to when the Doobie Brothers come.
Yeah.
Bring us food.
Uh-huh.
And of course, what else is happening? The water is running dry. So 30 gallons of water you can do, but they say for sailing, 1 gallon of water per day per person is what you need. So they had about 15 days of water.
Yeah, I mean, you're out in the salt water under the sun. I drink 1 gallon of water just sitting on my couch.
I know, you're so hydrated. Your skin is so good. So I guess the point is, you know, it's a pattern, right? It's Buck says, don't worry about it, we'll use the compass. And Stephanie says, yeah, sure, that sounds great. Except for, I know that we're going to die if we do that, you know?
Yeah.
And then he's like, everything's fine. And she's sitting there drinking black coffee every day and trying not to eat any food.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But things were still kind of working. The dogs were still alive. Buck started to shake off whatever dark mood had been clouding him since they left Hawaii. Like after they kind of figured out this navigation thing, he started to perk up a little bit and they started to embrace what they were doing. It wasn't perfect, but you know, whatever. The sunburns kind of healed. They were just getting naked and hanging out on the boat.
Yeah.
They were fishing. Buck caught a 30-pound tuna.
Damn.
And
that's good eating.
Yeah. And he got the hook caught in his thumb, and that was kind of scary. But it worked out. They had the 30-pound tuna. They saw a school of porpoise going in the water. They smoked some weed. They just got back to basics.
Yeah,
right.
Right. Yeah, yeah. They feel like they survived some insurmountable odds, so now they have a new lease on life, even though it was just them that put them in that stupid-ass position to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. Again, doesn't that remind you of us?
Yes.
By the two-week mark, Stephanie calculated they were about 120 miles from Palmyra. So remember, they started at 1,000 miles. And so right. Now they're right at the end of the journey and they were making good time. But the next day they hit the doldrums, which is really scary. I didn't know what these were, but it's basically because of heat and ocean currents. It's this largely windless area near the equator where sailboats can get stranded because there's no wind.
Oh, so doldrums is a nautical term.
Yeah.
Because people say you have the doldrums, it's just like kind of having like a low level blues where you're sort of like don't have energy.
Right. So this is literally the place around the entire earth where there's just no energy.
Man.
It's just kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So for days they sat drifting in this water under a gray sky, unable to calculate their position because they couldn't see the sun with no wind. And then finally, on June 19th, the sun broke in the morning and Stephanie was able to make another calculation. They were 20 miles away from Palmyra.
Wow.
So hopefully they'd spot it by 3 p.m. And a few hours later, there it was, like a little mirage, perfect emerald green Cheerio in the middle of the ocean wrapped around a sapphire blue lagoon.
Beautiful.
And there in the area, just outside the channel of Palmyra, they sat for the next 8 days completely stranded at sea, unable to enter the lagoon because they no longer had a functioning motor.
Oh, those. That's. This just keeps, this is the gift that just keeps on giving. How is this real? It's like in John Wick 4, if anyone saw that, when he's running up the stairs. It's just like, how's he going to kill 100 people? Then he gets knocked down the whole set of stairs. He has to go back. It's just like these insurmountable odds when you're so close.
Yeah, so close. And, you know, for what it's worth, if you want to get into the psychology of this couple, basically Buck was like, didn't even acknowledge it, not apologize. Not anywhere near that. He wouldn't even say, oops, the motor's frozen. He just was like, well, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And Stephanie doesn't want to accuse him. You know, she's the same way. The river is flowing. The river took us here. The river ruined our motor. So we're just not going to, they just don't talk about it. They're easygoing, right?
Okay.
But the reality is Stephanie had responsibly conserved their fuel and Buck had left the outboard motor on deck for so long it had frozen. So now they were stuck having to navigate their way into the Palmyra Lagoon through this long, narrow channel with just their sails, completely surrounded by ancient boat-destroying coral just below the surface of the water.
Right.
So sailing into this channel, I can't stress, is like really, really, really hard. Uh-huh. It's about, I believe it's about 20 feet wide. So, I mean, a narrow channel. And my impression is it's like trying to thread a needle while swinging around in a tire swing while a handful of dudes blast you from different directions with leaf blowers. Like Buck and Stephanie needed power from the wind to move at all, right?
Yeah.
But it had to be the correct speed from a perfectly precise direction for them to be able to get all the way through the channel in like a straight line.
No, this would be the part of the story where you and I start immediately going in circles and crash into the razor sharp coral.
So they waited day after day after day for the perfect wind with their island just out of reach. And fixated, Stephanie just watched Palmyra day and night. And she had this kind of pit in her stomach because at night she couldn't help but think she was seeing lights somewhere on this deserted island. Mm. So on June 27th.
Oh, that's a pit in the stomach.
On June 27th, the wind was as right as it was going to be. And Stephanie and Buck seized the day. They charged the reef. The wind died. The Iola got caught in the back current and then smashed into the coral, running aground on the reef. And they were completely stuck.
Oh,
there was nowhere to go. So they're on the boat trying to figure out what to do. Dogs are running around barking. It's chaos, right? Pooping, peeing. So Buck dives down into the water amongst all of this, you know, coral and deep sea stuff to just see what the damage is. And the good news was the iron part of the hull had taken the hit. There was a big section of the hull of the boat mm-hmm. that was just solid iron. So they were stuck, but thankfully the boat was not, you know, structurally damaged.
Mm-hmm. Not taking on water.
Exactly. Well, it was taking on water, but not as okay. much as it had
been. There's not a big ass hole in the bottom of this boat.
Exactly. Okay. So Buck is trying to figure out what to do, how to get off this reef. He dives in the water again to take a closer look. And then seconds later, Stephanie sees him catapult himself back in the boat, white as a sheet. And he says, "Hey, man, there's a 6-foot shark down there." And in fact, there were a lot of sharks in the water. So it was at this moment, while they're stuck on the coral with no motor, surrounded by water and sharks, that they hear this wonderful, terrible sound. Outboard motors coming over from Palmyra. Mm-hmm. The uninhabited island had a couple of inhabitants, and they were currently buzzing across the lagoon in their dinghies to help.
Oh.
So.
No. And are these going to be some of the people that get murdered?
There were ahoys exchanged and ropes thrown. And in moments, the Iola was freed from the reef and towed to the shores of Palmyra. Stephanie handled the pleasantries the entire time. She was chipper, relieved, really keyed up to have finally made it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable. They're like, "It took us 28 days. And people are like, "Oh, what?" She's like, "We're here." They're like, "Leave."
I think that would be the log line for this entire story.
Okay.
Buck, however, was really tense. Silent. Remember, he's Roy Allen now. He's got stuff to lose, and he's also Buck. Who knows what's going on with him? He didn't even speak to the people who rescued him. And as they're motoring to the shores of Palmyra, Buck, who's been silent this entire time, no thank yous, no hellos, no nothing, just manages to spit out one thing to Stephanie. He just mutters to her, "Remember, I'm Roy Allen now, right? And you better not make any dumb mistakes." And, you know, Stephanie could navigate 1,000 miles across the ocean. She could remember Roy Allen. But she wasn't sure how much that was going to help her man, who at some point had felt the need to tattoo his real name in giant letters across his arm. She's just like, "Okay, Roy, fine." The Iola was dragged to the north shore of the West Lagoon, kind of kitty corner from the channel, and then moored right in between two larger visiting ships of the men who had rescued them. On the one side was the Caroline. That was a 44-foot chartered sailboat with a powerful built-in diesel engine from Honolulu. The Caroline had ferried in a group of amateur radio operators who were all over the island running around, like setting up antennas and talking about... It's a
fully functioning society.
And then Buck and Stephanie's neighbor to the other side was the Poseidon. That was a big old 48-foot double-masted sailboat helmed by none other than the self-proclaimed mayor of Palmyra himself, Jack Wheeler, who was sailing with his teen son, Steve, his wife, Lee, and daughter, Sharon. So they've got this guy who's like the King Kong of Palmyra, and then just a giant boat of radio nerds running around.
Oh my God. Leave it. Why? Everyone wants to be the mayor or president of an island when they get to an island.
Yeah, we had the Baroness in the last story.
In our Galapagos Island story from a Patreon. Man, I know. I like, I guess it's just in the.
People want to be in charge.
I guess so.
After securing the Iola, Buck and Stephanie rowed the dogs ashore in their dinghy. After 28 days at sea, the dogs lost their mind on shore, thanking the dog gods for delivering them from hell. They were just barking and running around in circles and just...
So excited. Right. Like when you, those videos of when you see cows be freed and they're just like jumping around.
Stephanie dragged Roy... /Buck around for some socialization, introducing themselves to the radio guys and the mayor's family. And after all that, the mayor decided it was time for a tour. So this guy, Jack Wheeler, had been to Palmyra a bunch of times and was just pumped on the island.
Yeah.
So the mayor started his tour with a devilish gleam in his eye. First of all, did y'all know about the poisonous fish?
Okay.
There were kind of two versions of Palmyra. The Palmyra that looked like a postcard brimming with promises of paradise. And then the Palmyra with poison fish, aggressive sharks, and impenetrable spiky jungle plants.
Yes.
There was a toxic algae that grew in this crystal clear placid lagoon, and the fish regularly ate it and so were toxic to humans. So out of all these fish that they were planning on eating, and with no idea that this is true, out of all these fish, there are only two types of fish in the lagoon that were edible. The rest of them could kill them.
Yeah.
And that's something Stephanie and Buck would have learned basically in a trial by fire if they had been left to their own devices.
Totally.
Also, there were definitely sharks. There were hundreds and hundreds of black tip reef sharks prowling the lagoon, some as long as 6 feet. They're not super deadly, but they're actually among the most aggressive sharks in the Pacific Ocean, and they're just really prone to biting. So their bite probably won't kill you, but they're responsible for like a big percentage of just coming up and biting
you. I don't want to get bit by anything. I don't care if you don't have teeth and you have gums that actually feel good. I am not getting bit by a single damn sea creature. Sharks bite you, not aggressive, not deadly. What are you talking about? That would be worse, just getting bit by like 7 huge sharks and they weren't killing you. The best part about getting eaten by a shark is you die.
Well, these just bite you.
And you live with that?
All right, fine. So they've got most of the fish in the lagoon are poisonous.
Yeah.
You've got hundreds and hundreds of aggressive black-tip sharks. Also, there are these like monstrously fat wharf rats that hang out on the island and flying cockroaches amongst all the other.
Oh, this is great. This is hell on earth.
Another delight, the heat would remain relentless. The humid, thick air kept pretty much the same temperature day or night all year long. Even the rain, when it fell, was hot.
Yeah. That was my favorite part of living in Hawaii, is just like, it'll be raining at night and you're just like, you want to go swimming?
Yeah, right.
It's the best.
Yeah. One of the first stops on the tour was the main old airstrip. Remember we talked about this used to be a refueling station for Pan Am? So remember, like, we're talking, this thing is like a Cheerio, right? So it's not wide enough to support an airstrip on one side. So it like kind of lies lengthwise across the island.
Yeah, Muriel showed me a picture. It's not really a circle. It's more like a smashed up SpaghettiO or something.
Yeah, like an oval. Maybe that's the shape.
Oh, yes, there are such things as ovals, huh? What delicious cereal is an oval shape?
None.
Is there any? Okay. No.
So the mayor brings them to this airstrip. They get there. They can hear it before they can even see it because it's literally covered in thousands and thousands and thousands of screeching, pooping, nesting terns. Those are birds that kind of look like a small seagull wearing a black hat, just blanketed with nests and fledglings and terns and eggs.
Weird. So it's like the one unnatural concrete strip in the middle of this ocean, and the birds somehow just love that.
That's just where they are. You can hear it from before you can even see it. It's so deafening. Mm-hmm. Jack Wheeler, who I'm calling the mayor, was actually on Palmyra during that time on behalf of the Fullard Leos, the family who owned the island, because he was there to attempt to clear the birds off the airstrip and get it functional again.
But is that news to everyone that this island is actually owned?
It's definitely news to Buck and Stephanie. Yeah. It's like it's considered an American territory, uh-huh. but Buck and Stephanie didn't know these private, you know, they were these private owners. So they're learning all this stuff as the tour is going along. And as the group comes up on the airstrip, Buck's dogs charged into the bird madness. And before anyone could think, his pit, Popolo, bit one of the terns completely in half. So Buck starts punching the dog in the head a couple of times. And Popolo dropped the bird, but it was already dead. And Jack Wheeler's watching this whole thing like, not impressed, right? He's not impressed with the training level of the big dogs. He's not really sure what's up with Buck, but like, this is not a great first impression.
Yeah.
Buck didn't seem to care, but he pulled out some rope and tied the dogs up to a tree, kind of in an attempt to placate this meddling, question asking mayor. Right? And as much as Buck wished Jack Wheeler would just disappear, he was glad for the information and maybe the opportunity to ingratiate himself to this family who he now found out owned the land. Like, maybe they'd make Buck and Stephanie island caretakers. Crazier things have happened, right? Mm-hmm. So he's like, okay, maybe I need to make a good impression on this mayor guy.
Yeah.
So Jack Wheeler continued to probe Buck and Stephanie about their plans on Palmyra. When Stephanie mentioned planting a garden and living off the land, the mayor was like, well, okay, so you're really going to stay here for a while. You need to write a letter to the Fullard Leos for permission. Mm-hmm. So now it's already getting complicated.
Yeah.
And Buck kind of sidestepped the suggestion of the letter by jumping up and offering to help with the airstrip cleanup, something any normal non-fugitive with caretaker potential would do, right?
Right.
So the tour continued on with all the abandoned military facilities and equipment on the island left over from World War II. You remember that from the first mm-hmm. episode. So there was an old outbuilding with a working fridge and freezer inside with hookups for a generator that the mayor used to make coconut ice cream out of like the coconut milk.
Oh, damn. He should be the mayor.
Yeah. There was a shack filled with barrels of old gasoline for free use. Anyone could take them.
Awesome.
There was even a rainwater bathing system. Someone had rigged a hose from an old 12,000-gallon tank to a clawfoot tub, and the top of the tank had been pried off. So the tank continuously collected rainwater. It was undrinkable, but fine for washing.
Yeah.
And then there was a valve, and you could just turn it, and the water would come out, and you'd have a fresh bath.
Beautiful.
And while the mayor was side-eyeing Buck's wild dogs, the only real rule he felt he needed to pass along to Buck and Stephanie was the Fullard Leo rule about coconut trees. If you want coconuts, you gotta shimmy up to get them, because no one was supposed to cut down any mature trees on the island. So mm-hmm. either take the young coconuts or climb and get them. After the tour, Buck and Stephanie were invited to board the Caroline for drinks and joints with the radio guys. And kind of, despite the fact that they were thinking no one was going to be there, ended up being not a terrible day.
Yeah, right. No, that sounds... I mean... Yeah, I know they wanted something different, but they couldn't have handled what they were going for.
Right, right. And they kind of kept the raggedy train on the tracks.
No, they're going to cut down these fucking coconut trees. I already know.
The mayor brought Buck and Stephanie some fish. Stephanie baked the mayor bread. Buck helped clear the airstrip. Buck's pit bull bit the mayor's son, but they did get over it.
Okay.
Right? They did get over it, et cetera, right? One step forward, two steps back, mm-hmm. sort of, we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And this was punctuated, of course, by hard lessons the couple was learning about surviving on the island, like the time they got their dinghy stuck on a small sandbar in the lagoon. Buck got out to push the dinghy, like one would, right, to get it off the sandbar, and three black-tip sharks charged him at the same time. So after...
Velociraptor style.
Screaming... He jumped in the boat. The boat really almost tipped completely over. They lost one of their oars. You know, it was very close. Stephanie learned a lesson. She would never go back in the lagoon again. So just days after Stephanie and Buck touched down on Palmyra, more boats pulled into the lagoon.
They're like, where are we going to make this weed farm happen?
An ironical parade of disappointed yachties thinking they were sailing into their own very own private deserted island.
Yeah.
As the amateur radio operators left Palmyra, like clockwork, another boat motored through the channel, this time a gorgeous 38-foot yacht called the Sea Wind. I'm going to try to describe this boat using words that I didn't have to Google.
Okay.
Okay, so it's a sailboat with two masts. It's wooden and built in 1947, white with a blue trim, and basically a specimen of a classic-ass yacht. Again, more like a ship in a bottle style than like Oprah's mega yacht, but definitely the kind of sailboat that made other boat people swoon. And not just because it was beautiful, it was also just deliciously appointed with survival gear. So a large customized cabin, all kinds of radios and piloting systems. It had a battery powered fridge, which was really rare in the 70s. An onboard workshop with all the equipment, like a lathe to literally create whatever hardware you needed. You could make a specific screw if you wanted to. And the boat even had two dinghies, not just one. This was a yachty's yacht. Think like less luxury and more just perfectly, painstakingly equipped for blue ocean cruising.
Yeah.
So like not something you can just go to a yacht lot and buy. This is something someone hand polished and woodworked and customized for over a decade.
Right.
Something that basically was shining with sweat equity.
Yeah, man.
Now, Buck... now an ambassador of the ways of the mayor, jumped in his dinghy and rode out to meet the Sea Wind. Maybe island life had improved Buck's attitude. Maybe he saw this greeting ritual as a kind of power play, a way of saying, welcome to my island,
yes,
right?
Yeah, that's what I'm going with.
Regardless, Buck was all ahoys and smiles, offering to help guide the Sea Wind to the north shore, to the empty slot right next door to the Iola.
That old busted ass shit. Welcome to my island. Park next to that piece of garbage.
Malcolm Mac Graham III and his wife Eleanor Laverne Eddington, aka Muff. So this is Mac and Muff.
Mac and Muff.
They kept those,
man. They just went from the classiest people. Well, I don't know. I guess maybe that is like true one percenter sort of.
Yeah, Mac and Muff moves. For sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Although, just for the record,
yeah,
these guys are not one percenters. There's. We'll talk about them a lot in the next episode.
Oh, are they going to die?
There's a lot of, like, there's a trust fund and there's, like, a history of sailing in the family. But this is not, they're not rich people by any means. They are just trying to support their life at sea all the time.
Without having a job?
He has jobs.
Oh.
But they're odd jobs, like dock jobs. You know, okay. Things to kind of make ends meet.
And I then, get it. I get it. Yeah, okay.
So anyway, Mac and Muff. They take one look at Buck and the dinghy and they just keep on moving. They were friendly, okay?
They're like, hey, nope, we got it. Don't need your guidance at all.
They were very friendly, but not at all interested. Mac declined Buck's offer and instead expertly guided the Sea Wind to a little private cove just northwest of where the other boats were moored.
Buck's like, oh man, I didn't even know you could go over there.
Yeah, right. And the whole time, Mac is basically bossing Muff from the bow like a fancy captain. So Muff is the one with at the helm turning the wheel.
Right.
And Mac is saying, like, to the starboard, 2 more inches, 4 knots forward.
You right. Buck's like, hey. He's like, quiet, please. Muff, we're going. Yeah.
Right. And this very well-oiled sailing team.
Hilarious.
Right?
Hilarious.
So Mac and Muff head to their beautiful private little cove and set up camp. And about an hour later, Mac and Muff come down the beach to say hello, brushing off the easy sail from Hawaii. Only 7 days.
Like, you can do it in 6 to 8. We love 7. 7 is the perfect.
Just about an hour later, after that, to everyone's horror, a fourth boat joined the pack. This time, the Journeyer, helmed by Bernard and Evelyn Leonard, happily docked in the spot next door to the Iola. The mayor stood on the edge of the lagoon, sideburns ruffling in the breeze, and rolled his eyes. He had never seen so many boats on Palmyra at the same time. Absolute freaking clown show. And this is where we'll pick up next week.
Oh, man.
We're going to meet all the new yachties. We're going to talk about what it's like on the island. And we are going to explore and learn about the lives of Mac and Muff, king sailors of the ocean.
I am so into it. And it's you don't have to wait till next week.
Oh, yeah,
next,
that's right. Sorry,
part,
my bad.
Part 3 is coming up right now, guys. We're still adjusting to this whole, you know, big drops of episodes once a month thing. You know what I mean?
Nah, I just make mistakes.
Thank you so much for listening to Miro's Murders. This lady did all the research, writing, and hosting, and I did all the recording, editing, and post-production. This podcast was recorded in the jungle gym of our cat, Bongo.
To help support the podcast and to unlock exclusive episodes, you can sign up for a Patreon at patreon.com/Muriel's Murders. We have another island themed episode on there right now.
Yeah, that's yeah.
Really enjoyable about another set of murders on the Galapagos Islands.
Indeed. And if you are really into this freaking, you know, five-part freaking series, I can't remember what we're calling it, the Palarma murders. I don't know. We haven't done that part yet. Whatever the title of this thing is, if you guys are really into it already, please share it with the loved ones in your life and post about us online. I don't know, some cool Discord forums. I don't know what people do online, but posting about us, I know, helps.
All right. Your support keeps us inspired and motivated.
Other great ways to help the show include leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Rating, reviewing us on Spotify.
Connecting with us on social media.
Plus, we love hearing from you.
Our DMs are open and you can email us.
You can find all that information and the links in the show notes of this episode, or you can visit our website, murielsmurders.com.
Our music is by Mario Castellini. Find him on Instagram.
That's it.
Castellini Beats.
Oh, sorry. That's it. You're free.
Okay.
Go.
Bye.
Go outside.